This edition of The Entrepreneurs was first broadcast on the 8th of May 2013 on Monocle 24. The Entrepreneurs, in association with Pictet. Hello and welcome to The Entrepreneurs, Monocle 24's weekly business show. I'm Sophie Grove. South Africa is one of the biggest wine producers in the world, one that's been dominated by white South Africans for hundreds of years. We'll take a tour of the first black-owned wine label in the Cape.
Your wine must stack up against its competitors and at the price point. And as a bonus, the consumer must realize, but okay, they're doing something fantastic here because it's a black empowerment, the social transformation, there's fair trade behind it.
Then we'll meet a company that hopes solo workers of the world will leave their home offices and take up a work desk in another company.
Freelancers need to constantly keep in touch with people in a wider ecosystem of disciplines and agencies, and this really gives them an opportunity to do that.
And we'll meet the woman who's launched the now famous British handbag company with a budget of only £600.
I think if you have a really, really clear objective to the point that you know I'm going to have school fee bills three times a year, this is when they're going to come in, makes it very clear to see what you're going to need to make it viable.
We'll also meet the CEO of photo icon Shutterstock, talk with an Oregon environmentalist whose biofuel business is powering a regional revolution in cleaner fuels, and give travel agents a branding overhaul with our friends at Wink Creative. All that and much more coming up this week on The Entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 82 of The Entrepreneurs. I'm Sophie Grove. We start the show in South Africa, a country that's one of the biggest wine producers in the world. Harvesting season in the winelands, just over half an hour from Cape Town, has just been completed, and there's a consensus that 2013 was an exceptional vintage. It's good news for an industry that's undergoing a fundamental transformation. It has been dominated by white South Africans for several hundred years. Today, nearly 20 years after the first democratic elections, the division still largely remains between white owners and black workers, despite a series of initiatives and growing pressures to change the face of the industry. Leonie March visited a successful pioneer, the first ever black-owned wine label in the Cape.
At first sight, the vineyards of Tundi look like all the others in the Cape Winelands. Rows of vines as far as the eye can see, growing on a gentle mountain slope. Men and women in blue overalls are carefully cutting the ripe grapes. One of them is Lucinda LaRue, but she's not just an ordinary farm worker, she's also a shareholder in the company.
This is a kind of investment, you see, being a shareholder. And some of the people, it's just about the money, but for me, no, you must do it yourself. For a shareholder, in my opinion, it's an honor being a shareholder and work there.
Lucinda belongs to one of the 250 farm worker families that hold shares in the company and own land on three farms. This is still unusual in the Cape, where land has been passed down through generations of white owners. For centuries, black and mixed-race workers lived in dire poverty, were partly paid in alcohol, and suffer the social consequences until today. Established in 1995, only a year after the first democratic elections in South Africa, Tundi became the country's first agricultural black empowerment project. This brave and visionary step was initiated by the neighboring commercial farmer. His son, Paul Kruger Jr., chairman of the Tundi Wines Board, remembers.
My father's opinion was very much, if I'm going to stay in South Africa, I need to make a positive difference and play a role in my community in making it more prosperous. And this is where we partnered with SAFCOL, which was a government parastatal company, and they gave 100 hectares of state land, and our family gave 100 hectares of our private land. And that was given at a discounted rate to a joint venture company between ourselves, which is a commercial partner, the community, and at the time also SAFCOL.
The local community first began to produce apples, pears and plums on the land before creating the wine brand. Besides the access to land ownership and startup capital, the ongoing mentorship and transfer of skills were crucial in the development of the company to now be successfully run by the people, Vernon Henn, general manager of Tundi Wines, explains.
Community with a history of for three generations being just laborers, you know, and suddenly there's an opportunity to be a farm owner and a business and a businessman. For that requires, you know, proper transfer of skill and mentorship to allow that people to take this forward. In Tandi's case, we had a wonderful mentor in Paul Kluwer. And with the wine business itself, when Tundi Wines was formed as a sub-development of the Tundi farm, the similar process was followed. You know, we were linked up with an existing wine player. And the idea was to offer them a share in the business, you know, create a win-win, allow them to build a branded business for Tundi with the Tundi's input, and then come to a point where it is sustainable and then cut loose, you know, and then continue on that basis as an independent black-owned wine company.
A number of similar projects have failed due to lack of mentorship skills or funding. Only 3% of the industry is in the hands of black people. Tundi has been a pioneer in many regards. In 2003, it became the first wine brand in the world to receive fair trade accreditation. Premiums and profits are ploughed back into the community in initiatives such as a creche for the children or tertiary education bursaries. But as important as the social impact is the quality of the wines, Vernon Henn stresses.
It was also approached by Tundi right from the beginning to say, let's focus on our quality, because the worst thing we can do it is for people to buy wine on some based on sympathy, you know, and maybe they buy it once and say, okay, I've done my good deed, but there's not a repeat purchase that can create a sustainability. So we decided from the word go, it is bang quality. The wine must stack up against its competitors and at the price point. And as a bonus, the consumer must realize, but okay, they're doing something fantastic here because it's a black empowerment, the social transformation, there's fair trade behind it. So that's the feel-good factor that just complements the purchase.
The business of wine is not easy. It involves the risks of every farming operation, is known as capital hungry and highly competitive in an international market. Tundi has produced 240,000 bottles last year, of which 98% are exported to the United States, Asia and Europe, including the UK. The company has just been expanded, with two more black-owned brands coming on board, aiming for more synergy to cut costs and get access to further markets. In the cellar, workers are cleaning the stainless steel tanks. The fresh grapes have just been juiced, the skins in the strainer are now going to the press. A young woman is standing in the center of the huge hall, Alison Adams-Whitboy, Tundi's new winemaker, excited about her new job.
In this fair trade setup, you know, we know there's so many families in Tundi, there's 250 families, you know, that benefits from this project. It gives me goosebumps every time, you know. I absolutely love the Tundi story and the fact that it is real, you know. I mean, these are people that they own land, they work on it, and, you know, and they get the stuff back. And you don't get better than that, you know, to help people, to help themselves, you know, and help others around them. It's just absolutely awesome.
In the room next door, oak barrels are stacked up to the roof. Women are labeling bottles, polishing them and putting them in boxes ready for export. It has been a good vintage in the Cape and Tundi's customers have a great wine to look forward to, Alison Adams-Whitboy says with a big smile.
The Tundi Sauvignon Blanc 2013. I think that would be a very exciting one to show. What I like about it is that, you know, it is very, very characteristic of your typical Sauvignon Blanc flavors, but it also has a nice elegance to it. You know, it's not too grassy, it's got some nice strong varietal characteristics coming through, but it's also a bit round on the body. So this will then be my official first Tundi wine 2013 to put in bottle.
With this wine and Alison joining the company as a winemaker, a full circle has been completed. From growing the grapes to marketing and making the wines, the entire value chain is now managed and owned by the Tundi people. For Monocle in the Cape Winelands of South Africa, I'm Leonie March.
We head now to the world of work policy. Behind Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer's recent controversial no work from home policy is the knowledge that innovation is best born out of those serendipitous exchanges within workplaces. This view is echoed by some members of a growing tribe of solo workers. Whilst new technology enables them to work anywhere, working alone is not always conducive to idea generation and productivity. At the same time, many businesses are having to downsize and face challenges in maintaining morale as the number of empty desks grow. Nick Couch, London creative entrepreneur and founder of Open Studio Club, spotted an opportunity here. Ian Sanders went to meet him.
Nick Couch was running a global brand agency when he spotted an opportunity. More and more creative workers were going freelance. At the same time, many agencies had spare desks. Enter his idea, Freedesk Here, a web-based listing service that gives solo workers the opportunity of a free, no-strings desk space in agencies around the world. So Nick, you had this idea, Freedesk Here, that kind of came out of you had spare space in your agency and you thought, why not let creative talent use them? Some people might think the obvious thing would be to sublet desks and, you know, earn revenue for them. Why wasn't that the way you wanted to do it?
Well, I think we were at a size where we were running quite a substantial agency at the time. There were over 45 people in London. We'd just opened an office in Paris, an office in Hong Kong. You know, we had capacity. We moved into a new office. We had we probably occupied it on a foot count. Probably staff count was about a third of the overall size of the space that we had. And it really isn't worth the while for the agency to, you know, divert from your growth strategy to, you know, suddenly enter into the letting business. We had this situation where we had desk space that was available, that was free. When it was not occupied, there was an echoey sense of atmosphere in the studio. And yet we didn't have the time, the energy, the resources to really go into, you know, the financial gain of letting a desk really wasn't something that was of interest for us.
So it's such a great, simple idea, Nick. What's in it for the solo worker, you know, the other way around? You know, you're the agency head. What's in it for the solo worker looking for a place to hang out?
Well, they get to not only get a free desk, and in most big global creative cities around the world, desk and studio space is incredibly expensive. So they benefit from having free desk space. But they also get to expand their network. Freelancers need to constantly keep in touch with people in a wider ecosystem of disciplines and agencies. And this really gives them an opportunity to do that.
So there's no strings attached for the freelance worker who's coming into the agency space. They're not obliged to do any work or do anything kind of by contra. But as you say, it's about nurturing kind of collaboration and maybe some collision of ideas. What do you think can be the benefits for kind of the culture of an agency just by the fact of bringing in kind of an outsider, that fresh perspective, that new thinking?
Yeah, we wanted to be really clear that this wasn't about a free desk in return for agency work. It's not a way of getting cheap labour. The agency offers the desk in a totally no strings way, and there's no charge at all. I think that, you know, one of the big buzzwords at this year's South by Southwest conference in California was serendipity. And we're seeing a lot of businesses talking about the sort of happy accidents that happen in hallways and in cafeterias, where people just informally get together and ideas come from that. And that can really have an impact on the entrepreneurial atmosphere of a business. And, you know, being able to bring in somebody to your agency from a completely different skill set really opens your mind to new ways of working and new types of problem solving.
And there's another dimension here, isn't there? Because people can go onto the website and find an agency in Melbourne or Berlin, which, you know, away from wherever they're currently based. And there's something there that links in the idea of traveling somewhere else and kind of aiding creativity. So talk to me a bit more about that side of things.
Yeah, that's one of the most, I think, exciting parts of the Free Desk Here initiative that we've started to see? I mean, the project launched in March, and already we're starting to see talent. There was an illustrator that was based in London, and he's gone to take a free desk in a studio in Berlin. There's a typographer stroke calligrapher who's moving out of Rotterdam to take a desk for 6 months in Brooklyn. And these, for me, are the really exciting stories that we're about to hear. There's also two psychologists did a report at the end of in 2009 that said that there is a proven link between travel and increased levels of creativity.
Right, let's go and meet an agency with some free desks. So I've come to the East London offices of Magpie Studios, which is a design agency working with clients ranging from the British Heart Foundation to the New York Times, and I'm with Magpie founder David Azurdia. Some people might think you're crazy, you know, letting solo workers come and have desks for free. What was it about the project that got you excited about taking part in it?
Well, we're a small design studio, and part of that is that we need to keep the staff, the creatives, fresh the whole time. And really, the chance to get involved in this initiative was based around that. You know, you get to bring in a completely fresh talent to the studio from a completely different walk of life. That was what really attracted me, the sense of bringing in fresh input. You know, you want fresh output of the studio, you've got to bring in fresh input.
So what kind of people are you seeking? Are you seeking people with particular skills, or are you seeking people with a particular mindset?
Skills probably are the mindset. I mean, it's a funny thing. It's a bit like a Lonely Hearts scenario. You know, you feel like you're answering, or when you're putting an ad on Open Studio Club, you feel like you're kind of looking for that perfect partner who's going to come in and fit well within the studio. That's, again, part of the thing of being a kind of close-knit family. You know, you need someone who's going to fit well. But really, it's just, I mean, anyone who comes in, who brings in a different skill set, that's what we were looking for. So just anyone who didn't cross over too heavily into the world of branding, what we look at. So in the end, we got in a marvelous illustrator, and she came in at a time that we were quite busy. So unfortunately, it wasn't quite as cross-pollinating as we'd hoped it would be. But yeah, certainly it was someone with a completely new set of ideas, new set of approaches that really kind of added to the mix of the studio.
Just finally, David, if there's a founder of an agency or MD of an agency listening to this and a bit unsure about embracing this free desk here, what kind of advice would you give to, you know, why they should kind of go for it?
I'd just say, what have you got to lose? I mean, what's the desk doing otherwise? If it's sitting there empty, get on the site and see who you can get in. I mean, it's completely flexible. That's the beauty of it. You know, request a copywriter, a journalist, an artist. So one guy got in touch, and one ad agency asked for a scientist to come on board. And I think just that opportunity to embrace fresh personalities, that's the great benefit of it all.
For Monocle in East London, I'm Ian Sanders.
Up after the break, we'll meet the woman who launched a multi-million pound company from her kitchen table. Stay tuned.
We loaded up a van and set up the tiniest little exhibition beside some very famous designers who were very kind to us and introduced us to other people. 2 years later, we started selling in America, all from this very small shop in the King's Road. That was Tricia Guild, our design and lifestyle entrepreneur, quoted from the Pictet Report. Pictet, experts in wealth management.
Welcome back to The Entrepreneurs on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove. Not all businesses start with a desire to simply make money. But that's exactly why Julie Dean came about founding her company. In 2008, she discovered her daughter was unhappy at school and set about thinking of ways to fund a private education. She took pen to paper at the kitchen table. On the list was an idea: sell traditional satchels. Today, the Cambridge Satchel Company employs upwards of 80 people and is worth millions. Her classic bags are sold all over the world, where they're considered to embody a particular Britishness. Monocle's Adrian Craddock met up with Julie Dean to talk about how she took her kitchen table concept to the world stage.
I'm a sort of a geeky, nerdy person. Natural sciences was my subject. I went to Cambridge, and periodic table, numbers, graphs, love all that stuff. So I got my Excel out and I made my list of 10 things Julie can do to make two sets of school fees, because you can't do it for one child and not the other, because they'll grow up hating each other.
That's very conscientious of you. So what was on that list?
There's absolutely no way that I am spilling all of my list. But I think that there were things on the list that when you think about 5 years ago in our area, there weren't fantastic places to have things like children's birthday parties. You know, and so you take a risk of British weather time or with children throwing up all over your house and stuff. But I thought could do something that was aimed at absolutely brilliant venues for parties or soft play area, all that kind of thing. And I love gardening, I love baking. So there were lots of things that were connected to those. But the problem when you have things like that is, first of all, I had £600 that I was going to set towards this project, mm-hmm. Which didn't seem to me to be an unrealistic budget. But now I've been laughed at so many times, I realise it probably was on the low side. But lots of those things on the list took a lot of capital to set up. So those got sort of slated on the Excel column. And then there were other things at the other end of the list that probably over time they would have built, but they wouldn't have built fast enough to have been able to the cash flow needs of school. I think if you have a really, really clear objective to the point that you know I'm going to have school fee bills 3 times a year, this is when they're going to come in, makes it very clear to see what you're going to need to make it viable.
So one of those ideas took off in a major way. The Cambridge Satchel Company now turns over around about £12 million a year. When you flick through fashion magazines, almost invariably now, you see your product, you know, on the shoulders of celebrities around the world. Was that something that ever occurred to you when you started this business? Was that the kind of market that you were aiming at?
Yeah, no, not at all. And in fact, I'd have looked at that and thought, how do people even get to those people? You know, how do you get those people to hear about your company or what you do? You know, that seemed like another world in many ways. And so what I was banking on was that, like me, that there would be parents out there who are really tired of school bags that aren't up to the job and they look dirty or they're not well made or they just don't last the course or they've got some stupid, you know, monster on it that then the child grows out of and needs replacing all the time. So somebody who thinks back and thinks, I had a school satchel and at the end of it, it looked all beaten up and showed what I'd been through and it looked fantastic. I want my child to have one of those.
Mm. One of the great things about your satchels is the colours.
Yes.
That's become one of the great trademarks of the brand. You know, these amazing colour variations,
yep,
from kind of neon yellow to,
yes,
to pinks and then, of course, the kind of classic brown hazelnut coloured, yep, satchels. How did that come about? I mean, how did that progression happen from, you know, making these handsome kind of brown satchels and then taking a big risk on these colours?
You're right. It is a risk. It's a huge risk because people won't go out and just dye enough leather to make one satchel for me to see what people think of it. So in the beginning, I had found a manufacturer that a long time ago would make school satchels, and we'd worked together and modified it, and we were really happy that we had something. And he made other leather products, and so I could only use colours that he already had to make other things. And then, hallelujah, he had a project in that needed red leather, so I could use some of that leather for my satchels. And we saw how well the red went. That really, really caused a bit of a stir, and people loved it. And so I knew we were going to have to branch out and have a new colour. It's 500 square foot is the minimum amount of leather that you can have dyed in a bespoke colour. And that translates to about 110 satchels. So
that's a fair amount of eggs in a certain basket. You have to really trust that.
Absolutely. And at the rate that we were selling then, you know, in the beginning, that could have taken about 4 months to sell. What I did was I contacted one of the big fashion blogs, the What I Wore blog, and we ran this competition and it said, you know, what colour would you most like to see added to the Cambridge Satchel palette? And thankfully, about 80% of the people who responded to it said Kelly Green.
Okay.
So a sort of really strong Irish green. And there were so many people replied to it that what I did then was I emailed all of them and said, well, congratulations, you've picked the winning colour, and so would you like one of the very first Kelly Green Cambridge satchels, and we'll give you free shipping and all this kind of thing. And so as a result of that, I managed to sell twice the minimum quantity that I needed to sell before I even had to pay to have the leather dyed.
They're exclusively made in England, is that right?
Well, in the UK, there's a manufacturer that we've used almost from the start-up in Scotland, and then we have one in Wales as well.
Why have you made that decision?
I've made that decision because I feel a real connection to these bags. You know, when the bags arrive, it's exciting. I love it. And there's something about if I couldn't picture where they were made and I didn't know the people who were making them, all of a sudden they've lost their soul. You know, for me, they've lost what makes them special.
Do you think this kind of ethos of knowing where things come from, being responsible with manufacturing, is more important than ever?
I think it's just so important, because if you're putting your weight behind something and your belief behind something and you're building your business on something, how can you not feel that you know it inside out? And how could you, you know, deal with anything that really you should be ashamed of? If you go somewhere and say, oh, I had no idea my product was being made here, I'd never have had this, then why didn't you know? You know, because it's every level of Cambridge Satchel. There's nothing that we've done that I would feel ashamed of. Mm. You know,
even when you are in those early days of starting a business, and I imagine there must be a great temptation to find...
There's a huge temptation. I mean, there was one period when a manufacturer of ours had taken all of the trust and the ideas and the training and even the leather that we had used to launch a rival brand. And so I had to pull out of that manufacturer. He was one of my main manufacturers. And so I would not deal with anybody like that. But in saying I would not deal with anybody like that, that suddenly meant that my manufacturing was really crippled until I found another manufacturer, or in our case, we set up our own factory. And at one stage, we had 38,000 orders on back order, people waiting, and I just lost my main manufacturer. You know, that's having the backbone to stand behind your ethics, because I couldn't have said, oh, yes, well, I'll keep making and I'll keep dealing with somebody like that just until I'm on my feet and I've got an alternative supplier.
That was Julie Dean, owner of the Cambridge Satchel Company. Now, in the world of online stock photos, Shutterstock has ruffled a few feathers. The industry used to be dominated by a handful of companies who charged a premium to use their images. Then Shutterstock ruined the party. Its business model relies on allowing anyone from amateurs to professionals to upload their images and license them at more affordable prices to buyers. After going public in 2012, the company is now expanding into the premium market with a new sub-brand called Offset. Monocle's Adrian Craddock met up with Shutterstock CEO and founder John Oringer to talk about this new venture and his vision of the future.
Let's start back in 2003. That was a very important year for you. Before then, what were you doing?
Before 2003, I had a bunch of different software companies that were all small privacy protection shareware products that I sold on the web. I kind of just went through a whole string of them trying to figure out something that would work. I wound up creating one of the first pop-up blockers to market at that time.
And then you got pushed out of business in a way with that, didn't you?
Yeah, so Internet Explorer, Microsoft's product, built a pop-up blocker into their browser, kind of putting my company out of business overnight. Turned out that was just another natural kind of turning point in the life of an entrepreneur, because I looked back and kind of asked myself, throughout all the companies I had, what was the one thing I needed that I was having trouble getting? And it turned out getting high quality images at an affordable price that were easily obtainable didn't exist.
And you were somewhat of an amateur photographer yourself, is that right?
Yeah, I'd taken photos before and taken photo classes, but I'd never sold a photo commercially. In order to figure out if I could create such a product, I went out and I shot 100,000 images. I culled the collection down to 30,000. I put them on a website and created a subscription.
Did you ever consider completely putting the tech entrepreneur thing aside and becoming a professional photographer? Or was this just kind of a means to an end in a way?
It was more of a means to an end. I'm a software developer. I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I wanted to start businesses. So when it came down to figuring which one, I really just wanted to figure out what was the one thing that the world needed at that time.
And I've watched interviews with you. So obviously in 2003, you founded Shutterstock. And you said that it disrupted the industry. It disrupted the stock photography industry. What exactly do you mean by that?
In 2003, the way you got images was through one of the traditional agencies, like a Getty or a Corbis. You would go online, search for an image, find it. You wouldn't know the price of the image until you enlarged that image. And then sometimes you would have to even kind of dig in and define the way you were going to use that image before you were quoted a price. How often you were going to use it, what was the audience size, what countries, how long were you going to use this image for. Those kind of questions didn't fit into the new media landscape that was building, which was the web.
And so the company has grown exponentially. I mean, how does Shutterstock find itself now in the marketplace?
So over the past 9 years, Shutterstock has gotten more and more popular amongst contributors and buyers. Today we have 40,000 contributors. We've sold 300 million images. We've paid out over $150 million to our 40,000 contributors.
That's a really interesting part of this story, because you're a success story in your own right, but also you've facilitated a lot of other people to be successful in the field of photography. Can you explain exactly, you know, how you set up that platform for that to happen?
Yeah, so that's one of the great parts of this business is watching people who had photography as a hobby become professional photographers and actually be able to make a living with photography. The way we did that is by just being transparent and being upfront with our photographers and telling them exactly how much they're going to make, and also communicating back to them exactly what's selling at the moment. So the way this network effect got going was communicating all the download data back to the contributor in real time. So as the contributors see what's getting downloaded, they upload more images like those. And the library is kind of this organically created library that's based on customer demand.
Who was the main market for these photos? Who was buying this photography that you were getting through the site?
So we started off by selling to the small business, kind of the business that I had that I knew about, where, you know, one day you need something for your website, the next day you're sending out an email blast to your customer list, and maybe you want to try two different images with that email blast to see which one works better, to learn more about your customers. Kind of just this need for a lot of imagery. Today we sell to the tens of millions of small businesses around the world, all the way up to the big mega media agencies and publishers around the world, the kind of textbook publishers and media companies that you would see billboards every day.
Because your market that you're aiming at is changing slightly, especially now because you're launching a new product. So Offset, this new brand, this part of Shutterstock, is trying to get into the more editorial side of photo stock, so magazines, high-end imagery. What's been the challenge in making that transition?
Well, with Offset, we wanted to create something completely new. So the typical way that a stock photo agency would go about this in the past is to just kind of find the best of the collection and raise the prices. We didn't want to go in that direction. We wanted to do things kind of in our own way and in a Shutterstock way. We wound up creating a new brand called Offset, and we went out and we found collections that had never been sold as stock before. Stuff that, you know, was previously in collections with National Geographic or Martha Stewart or some other high-end kind of buyers. And we found amazing imagery, that this kind of stuff that tells a story that you would find on the cover of a magazine or in a two-page spread. Those images are around $500 a piece. And we feel like that's a disruptive model also.
You almost smirk when you say disruptive. I mean, do you kind of get a kick out of really shaking this market up in a way?
Well, by shaking the market up, we give more opportunity to both sellers and buyers. The world's getting more visual. Buyers need these images at these price points. What we're doing is we're allowing businesses to create their products and services and market them in ways they weren't able to do before. We're making the world more efficient by doing this.
So how do you see the business going forward from here? You've also expanded into video footage. Is that the next key market for you?
Yeah, we've actually been doing, been selling video footage in the marketplace model for a while. We were actually the first to sell it in the marketplace model way. It's taken a little while to catch on because one of the key factors to making the marketplace work is getting professional level equipment in amateurs' hands. That's just starting to happen over the past couple of years. For instance, the GoPro little camera that costs a few hundred dollars shoots 4K video in a pretty amazing way. People are shooting professional looking video with that. Getting more of that equipment into amateurs' hands so that they continue to iterate and get better and better at what they do is going to create the content that we need to sell to our customers.
That was CEO and founder of Shutterstock, John Oringer, with our own Adrian Craddock. Over to the Pacific Northwest of the United States now. Here we meet Ian Hall, an environmental studies major at the University of Oregon, who became disenchanted with how big businesses were treating our planet. Instead of simply complaining, he started a biofuel business that is powering a regional revolution in cleaner, sustainable fuels. Monocle's transport editor Tristan McAllister, on assignment for our June transport survey, caught up with him at Sequential Biofuels in Eugene, Oregon.
Tyson, my business partner, we met probably, 15 years ago when I was working at his family restaurant as a cook, and he was a dishwasher, and we were both students at the University of Oregon. And
at Mozzie's?
At Mozzie's, yep. Mozzie's family restaurant, yep. And actually, Mozzie's is the first place that I started taking oil from when I first got into biodiesel and was making it for myself in a garage.
So Tyson talks about a car fire. Mm-hmm. Is that what happened?
Yep. That's part of our story. I had a truck that I was driving to California with my girlfriend, and we're in the middle of the Sacramento Valley, and it overheated, and actually overheated to the point that it caught fire and burnt to the ground. And as I was standing there, I was just, I don't know if you've ever been to the Sacramento Valley, but it's this kind of amazing landscape that when you really look at what's happening around you, you realize that you're in the middle of a huge industrial complex. You know, the valley itself is this agro-industrial complex, and, there's very little on the landscape but big machines and then fields of monoculture. And it struck me how much we've changed the landscape as I sat there and watched the column of smoke pouring off my truck as it burned down. But I guess the real point of that story is that the truck fire gave me an insurance settlement that allowed me to, for the first time, had the chance to buy any vehicle I wanted. So we didn't buy anything. We just upgraded our bikes and researched for about a year. Electric vehicles, ethanol, human powered transport. And through that process, I ended up discovering biodiesel on the internet and started working with that. And it was such an amazing time at that point globally, because the internet had really just kind of really become a powerful tool. I don't know if you grew up with the internet just emerging, and there was this period of time where everybody was hoping it was going to be this big thing, and the dot-com bubble happened, and it was kind of disappointing to a lot of people. But I mean, at this point, it's an incredible thing, but it's taken a while. At that point in 1997, 98, it was just on the cusp of becoming that incredible thing that it is now. And one of the ways I interacted with the future of the internet was by being able to strike into this global conversation about making fuel for yourself. And I discovered that there was just this international community of people that were fed up with fossil fuels, totally dismayed with the fact that they had no choice but petroleum if they wanted to drive a vehicle or even purchase fuel or purchase any products at a store. They're all brought to us with petroleum. So that group of people, in a global manner, had started a conversation about how you do it for yourself, how you make your own fuel. And that's what got me sucked into biodiesel.
Now you, sir, are no scientist.
Oh no, not at all. More of a naivete and somebody willing to set aside the draw of riches to try to do something that is, one, interesting and has a small chance of being a part of what I perceive as a real needed shift for our species. We've been living off the piggy bank of fossil fuels, but the piggy bank's running out. And how prepared we are for when the bank account runs dry is, that's a monumental question for our species, is how we deal with that turning point. And not that sequential is much of an answer, but it's a little piece of an answer. And I think that's what keeps Tyson and I really excited and engaged.
I'm standing in a gas station that is a real consumer-facing part of what you do that doesn't just sell fuel. Can you tell me about where we're standing?
Yep, we're standing at our first station in Eugene, Oregon, and it's right off Interstate 5, which is a major interstate corridor going up and down the West Coast. And we're standing inside the building, which is, well, I guess before I talk about the design elements, part of what I was speaking to with the brand was that we felt there was an incredible opportunity in the fuel industry to differentiate ourselves, in that for the past 100 years, gas stations, convenience stores went from being incredibly diverse, having lots of variety and kind of options to them, to becoming essentially entirely the same. And that's the point we're at now. I mean, if you go to any gas station in America, you will find the exact same products. And so we felt that there was an incredible opportunity to do something different and to serve a demographic in the marketplace that just was absolutely being ignored by gas stations. But to reinforce that, we're really conscious of not wanting to greenwash, and we wanted to walk the walk. So we built a station that we think does that as well as we could. The building itself is a passive solar design. My mom's an architect, so I was able to work with her, which was a lot of fun. We use about 35-40% less energy than a typical gas station, simply because the building is allowed to kind of breathe for itself. And it was built in such a way that it's oriented favorably towards the sun. So we get the heat of the sun when we want it, and we're able to keep it out when we don't.
And then beyond what this building is and what this cool concept is, what can we find in the store? I think that's one of the more remarkable things here, because I just walked in and I heard someone order almond milk, and no one scoffed and said, "What's that?" or "We don't have that." That's weird at a gas station, right?
Yeah, unfortunately for us, but unfortunately in general, because the fuel station business has become so homogenized that there's not a lot of creativity in it, and we saw that as an opportunity, and we looked towards the Whole Foods model, or if you're an Oregonian, the New Seasons model up in Portland, and tried to apply that to our station. So that means that we're very focused on offering locally sourced organic products as much as possible, and also a range of products that can fit different dietary needs, like non-dairy substitutes for your latte. I think we have almond, hemp, soy, and there's some others I'm probably forgetting, rice. There's a challenge to that. There's a price to be paid on the business side, and that's that a typical gas station probably deals with maybe a dozen vendors, maybe. If you're a big chain, then you're probably dealing with less than that. For us, we deal with something like 60 to 70 vendors. And that's great. It's cool. It's also a business challenge. But so far, we've been able to make it work.
I'm looking out the window here. And just beyond your beautiful gas pumps here, I see something else. It's your competition. Let's talk about the competition. I mean, I see your gas prices are slightly higher. How do you pull that off? I mean, it's very clear that they could get a better deal going next door.
Well, I think it's simply put that there is a segment of the population that is just fed up with big oil, is not interested in spending the money that they already spend on fuel continuing to support that paradigm, and that they're interested in having their fuel dollars, even if it means slightly more. I mean, we try not to be a lot more. We try to be in the market. I think today for our regular gas, we're 10 cents over the 76 station next door. But we also try to deliver a value promise in return for that extra price. And that's emblematic in how we built the station and in the products we offer in the store. And hopefully we provide better service as well.
What do you see for you as an entrepreneur in 10 years? Have you opened other stations, and do you see opening more?
I really don't have a clue what's going to happen in 10 years. And I would love the opportunity to go further with what we're doing so far. I'm not sure that means retail. We have opened a second station here in Eugene. We probably have opportunities to do a couple more in Oregon. It's kind of limited. There's some challenges with it, in particular real estate challenges. But I think the other parts of the business, I think the regional fuel production model, really focusing on waste streams as our primary feedstock source, I think that that has tremendous potential, not just for biodiesel, but also for ethanol. I think also for biogas, which would be a natural gas replacement. I think that those models are very, very strong and will continue to grow whether Sequential does it or not. But I certainly hope that we have the opportunity to continue growing into the business in those other areas.
That was our clean energy entrepreneur Ian Hill with our transport editor Tristan McAllister. We'll be back with our weekly branding chat right after this short break.
Entrepreneurs make new money. We protect it until it becomes old money. Pictet, experts in wealth management since 1805.
Welcome back to The Entrepreneurs on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove. Time now for our weekly branding chat, where our colleagues at Wink Creative mull over a branding problem and try and find some solutions. This week, we chatted about travel agents with Joel Todd and Karina Drossel.
There's been a lot of talk about the death of the travel agent. They often, relate it to, the wider fears about the death of the high street. It's quite interesting, on Monday, for example, 2,500 jobs were cut at Thomas Cook. And this sort of continues the debate, is that, whether the future of the travel industry is moving entirely online, and whether we will continue to use travel agents at all. You've got online aggregators like Expedia or Skyscanner, and they gather all of the information and they essentially do a lot of the job that the travel agent can do. And it's now very easy to book your entire holiday without having to speak to a single person.
It is kind of sad in a way, because in times of old, the travel agents used to be this really personal experience, and they were almost the gateway to your travels. And it used to be a lot more curated. Do you think that's what's lacking from travel agents these days?
I think certainly, yes. I think, in fact, that is the kind of the number one key why, in fact, people just don't go there anymore. And it's, of course, it's so easy to you can almost book your whole holiday without having spoken to one person. That goes down to car hire, pickup from the airport, of course, as hotels and destinations. It's really great to think about a time when you go to the travel agency, certainly in the 80s and early 90s, when you'd go there and you would be inspired, you feel like you get a sense of local knowledge. You had your travel agency in your town, and you had one person you'd always speak to. And it was kind of like a place where we're kind of the thrill of travel and good service kind of would almost traditionally meet.
You talked there about, travel agents, how they used to be in the 90s and so forth. I mean, when you go into one of the mainstream travel agents these days on the high street, like SCA Travel or, any of the others, personal is definitely not the first word that comes into your mind. How do you think they could do that better? I mean, has it got to do with the store design? Has it got to do with the way they train their staff? I mean, what do you think can be done better?
Going back to Corinna's point, I think one of the main things is that, we face a situation now where people are very time pressured, and holidays essentially should be about relaxation, about taking time out, and that should sort of start as part of the booking process, So when you go to visit a travel agent, it should feel like a place you want to spend time in, a place that you can relax in and get inspired. And absolutely, the physical spaces themselves are key to that, as well as, we said, the personal service. The majority of travel agencies, Trail Finders, which is a big one, for example, they're very tired and they feel quite generic. It just lacks the sense of being, new and fresh and exciting.
It's interesting to kind of see the way these travel agencies market themselves. It seems like gap years and, really focusing on young people, kind of almost fresh out of high school, that kind of demographic seems to be the norm. Do you think they've sold themselves short there in some ways? They've cut themselves off.
Well, I think in a way they're playing it safe, because we've learned that, in fact, the markets of cruise holidays and package holidays, and I think under this falls the gap year as well, these are the markets that actually haven't declined, and they've been quite steady over the years. So I think travel agents are most possibly playing it safe, kind of going straight to this audience. But I think what is obviously the other half is our generation, that have certainly, we're very much about kind of individuality. We define ourselves on where we go and on what we wear. And we have, you know, this, we've grown up with a sea of opportunities. And I think it's definitely for them a great chance to kind of address this through another way of marketing themselves.
We were talking before about how it's very hard to grasp onto any real brand identity with a lot of these high street travel agencies. Do you think that curation needs to come to the fore, that they need to kind of define themselves a bit more and have a bit more of a voice?
Absolutely. You know, there's a gap in the market, and looking at fashion brands and how they've reinvented themselves, you know, by publishing magazines, for example, the likes of Acne or Matches, you know, really great publications that, you know, that you want to read and you know, you kind of experience the brand outside of either online or the shop environment. And, you know, in the travel industry, you've got brands like Lonely Planet, which, you know, which are very trusted. And then on the other hand, you've got the Expedias, or you've got the Thomas Cooks that sit in the middle, but you haven't got an agent that sort of grasps that opportunity and that covers both the, you know, a strong point of view, a good editorial voice, with also, you know, a really good service. You know, having that end-to-end service from the point that you know, you pick up the magazine for inspiration, you go in store, you get the expert and the sort of the personal service, and then the aftercare with, you know, with online and on the phone as well.
Okay, so looking internationally, are there any agencies that you think do it really well? You know, who are the people that we should be taking cues from?
Definitely Kuoni, a Swiss travel agent that is international now. They're doing a great job. I think they've just refreshed their identity. They keep winning kind of travel awards, rightly so, because I think they definitely have this 360 approach, as you were just saying, Joel. They have a very kind of holistic approach to their identity, to their service. The in-store design, it feels very clean. It feels... it has a kind of right level of luxury without
cheesy connotations of you know, a luxury experience. You know, you get a lot of the sort of like Voyage Privé and all of those sort of, they just have this sort of naff, old-fashioned veneer of exclusivity, but they're not sort of luxury in a modern way.
I think a lot, like comparing this to like a more generic agency like Trailfinders, which is also international, I think. I mean, it feels like they've completely neglected their interior fittings, whereas in Kuoni, it's all considered, even down to their to the brochures, which this is kind of bordering on what we were suggesting before. Their brochures you can only obtain inside their shops, but they have a very strong editorial approach and they have great design. So it feels like you're reading a magazine. They're inviting journalists, travel writers to offer their point of view, so you feel like you get that little bit more from them.
Well, I've got to book a flight back to Australia quite soon, so I might be going into a Kuoni branch quite soon. So thank you so much for joining us on the Branding Corner.
And that's all we have time for this week. This show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. Our studio manager is Holly Fisher, and I'm Sophie Grove. Please feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or feedback. You can reach me at sgr@monocle.com and our producer Daniel at dg@monocle.com. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for more inspiring news and views from entrepreneurs around the world.